I'm going to introduce the panel, which is logistics at scale. So obviously, if you want to do things in the world, it helps to do those things with other people. If you want to do big things, if you want to, you know, get a lot of things done at large scale, there's going to be a lot of logistics coming up, logistics issues that you will need to solve, how to get things done, how to make things run smoothly. I'm not sure, once you've worked in an organization that isn't taking care of its logistics well, you will never again underestimate how great it is to have people taking care of logistics. So that's what this panel is going to be about. It's going to be moderated by Ruth Grace Wong, who is a site reliability engineer at Pinterest. And Ruth is going to take it from here and introduce the rest of the panelists.
Let's welcome them. Hi. Thank you, thank you. So my name is Ruth, and we've got some extremely talented individuals here. On the far end, we've got Haley Cashdollar. She works for Proterra, designing and building a factory to make batteries for zero-emission transit buses. And then next to her, we've got Glenn Matlin, who is a data scientist at LendUp, which offers loans. Glenn works on machine learning-driven underwriting and advanced product analytics, so he's our software computation representative. And then we've got Teresa Condor, who's the VP of Corporate Development of Aspire Global, which monitors 90% of global trade with satellites. She's an industry veteran for the distribution and supply chain. And then finally, we've got Diane, who's a full-time volunteer for ToastOn, an award-winning nonprofit that has brought non-formal human rights-based education to hundreds of communities in North and West Africa. So I have six questions for the panel, and then we will be taking audience questions, so you can submit questions at sf.eaglobal.org/polls. That's sf.eaglobal.org/polls. Or on the app, the Bizibo app. So the first question is, tell me briefly about how you got to the role that you're in now. And I guess we can start with Haley and move towards me.
Thank you for hosting us. I am a mechanical engineer by training. I went to the University of Colorado for my bachelor's degree, and from there I went straight to Tesla Motors, where I worked on the powertrain manufacturing engineering. So I designed and built equipment that made the rotor and the cooling systems for the Model S. I then found that I really liked the mechanical design on that equipment, but didn't know anything about the software. And so I went back to grad school, getting another degree in mechanical engineering with an emphasis on controls engineering. And in my current role, I explore both the software and the hardware side of manufacturing problems.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for hosting us. My background was really more about in econometrics, and I came from Florida, where we saw firsthand the kind of examples of bad financial lending in 2008. The subprime lending market kind of cratered all of Florida in terms of employment in the economy. Having studied that, I worked my way out towards San Francisco because I was very interested in trying to use my skills to build better financial services. Most of my work was in analytics, and a lot of self-trained, self-taught got me out here. So I'm much less of the academic on my team than others. So I tend to come from a do-it-yourself and work your way up kind of perspective on things.
Hi, everyone. I've been with Aspire Global basically since we started the company in 2012. I'm not technically a co-founder, but have been doing everything from the beginning with a co-founding team. I'm not technically in the space sector. So our company, Spire, builds satellites. We put them up into orbit, listen to the Earth and collect various types of data, and then sell the data as a service. And so I'm not traditionally someone coming from the space sector. I'm not even an engineer. What interests me about what we do at Spire is how you can use the data to have an impact on big problems, to help businesses be more efficient. So I think for the purposes of this this particular conference, the things that I'm interested in are our ability from our data to identify illegal phishing that takes place on a global basis, to monitor global trade patterns, to collect a unique type of weather information from our satellites in places like Africa and over the oceans where you have no other type of infrastructure that can do it.
Thanks again for hosting. I'm in awe of all of you. I'm Diane Gillespie, and I'm from the University of Washington, the Bothell campus. It's a very interdisciplinary, exciting place to be. I retired to help Toston, which is a nonprofit program operating now in 6 countries in West and North Africa. It is a 3-year non-formal human rights-based education program that works in resource-poor communities. It's probably best known for one of the effects of or outcomes of the program is that communities decide to abandon female genital cutting. There's the founder of this organization, Molly Melching, was recognized by the Skoll Foundation, and they did their first book called However Long the Night on how she came to create an organization that has had this kind of impact. My role as a volunteer is to work in monitoring and evaluation, and I also help with the training center.
Amazing. Thanks, everyone. So when you're doing something at scale, there's a huge opportunity for success, but there's also a huge opportunity for failure. So do you have any principles that you follow when scaling up? And also, what's the biggest mistake you've ever made? Starting from Haley.
Thanks for the question. There are so many mistakes that it is hard to choose from. I have found it very helpful to lean on and completely trust the people around me, because if you are scaling a project, you cannot do it by yourself. And that comes from hiring the right people to help you, but then putting your faith 100% in those people and letting them do the job that you hired them to do. One of the mistakes that we made as we rapidly scaled our manufacturing facility was overlooking ergonomics on one of our systems. And it's been a real pain to go back and try to figure out how we can help avoid injuring our workers on one particular piece of equipment. And if you are scaling really quickly, it is really easy to overlook those problems, that kind of problem. And I wish that we had taken a little bit more time to evaluate that particular part of that project. And I think that comes with actually a lot of hardware scaling anytime you're manufacturing.
So when you're operating at scale, I have found that really small decisions turn out to have a gigantic impact down the line. And they're the kind of decisions you never really end up thinking are important. They're the kind of decisions you make just because they seem so mundane. But I have found that the principle of really thinking slowly about what you're doing, but being very fast and deliberate about it, has been very useful. Taking the time to really consider all those small decisions and how they might impact you down the line is important. It lets you design and deal with edge cases. It lets you deal with situations where you get unexpected from behavior from people using your service or your software. There are so many small decisions that end up becoming really impactful later on. One of our co-founders, Jake, who's our current CTO, when he started the company, just decided to put floating point storage for the value of our loans. And I imagine this is like a really small kind of thing to people. But it turns out that when you're doing compliance for regulatory bodies, you need to calculate every single cent perfectly, and you can't really do that with imprecise floating calculations. That small decision 5 years later is a huge problem we had to go back and fix. And to this day, I think Jake would be like, you know, that was a kind of a mistake and it's a headache. But we now really think really tight and about every little decision we make in our architecture, because it pays off down the line.
I think fundamentally a principle that's important to us in looking at scale is to make sure that you have a problem and a solution that you should scale. And this means that it's big enough and it's going to impact enough people, but at the same time you can do it without having to move in lockstep with the same number of people that are trying to implement it. So what I mean is that if you're having an impact and you have to keep hiring the exact same number of people, that's not something that is going to scale, or you have to question whether you have the right solution. So you really want to have as wide a gap as possible in terms of the number of people that you impact and the number of people that it actually takes to affect that. And I think that's fundamentally the big problems that we want to tackle with our satellite constellation. You know, we're talking about the 1 billion people that rely almost exclusively on fish for their protein source, and the other 4 billion people that do eat fish in some way for their nutrition, 7 billion people on the planet that are all impacted by weather to some extent, and you know that continuing on. So big problems are the kind that really should scale. And if you need to hire too many people in order to do that, it just won't work. So people for us is really the biggest thing that we worry about, and probably the biggest decisions that we've made that have not gone well is hiring the wrong people or good people at the wrong time.
Wow. So the principle, I think, for Tostan has been fidelity to the curriculum it's created into its interactive pedagogy. And there's a lot of pressure to cut back anytime you're, especially they work in social norm change, and so people want to do it quicker and faster. So the integrity of the curriculum and the interactive way in which the curriculum is taught is really critical when you start to scale up. And there's when you do that, there's lots of pressures to kind of fudge it. The biggest mistake Tostan made, I'm not sure Molly Melching would say this, is that it went to Somalia to implement its program. Its national headquarters are in Dakar, Senegal. And it looked like a perfect setting because in Somalia, the worst type of female genital cutting is practiced. And people begged Tostan to come. But it was a challenge in many ways because of the distance and the training, but mostly there was no government. And so the people who were working to train the Somalians in the program were actually arrested. So it looked like a perfect setting, but the kind of unforeseen details that arose in the actual implementation made it just too difficult to continue the implementation.
Wow, that sounds like a very difficult situation. So the next question is, I work by day as a site reliability engineer, and I find that when we're at scale, I have to start writing systems to automate things, and then you start having to write systems to manage the systems. So what's something that you find that you have to do in a completely different way at scale compared to not at scale?
So when you're doing things at scale and you have to do something completely differently, I'm so sorry. I got out of order on that one.
Oh, what's an aspect of your work that you have to do differently at scale?
One of the big things that we have to really plan for is those edge cases that I was talking about, mainly because of the fact that we have to report and be held accountable by numerous government regulatory bodies at the federal and state level. So oftentimes, when you're in an environment where you're filled with people, around people who are like really energetic and they want to move fast and they want to do big things and they think they're really going to help people, we also have to make sure that we really think about every little decision we make, mainly because those edge cases can cause problems if we're not thinking carefully about what we do. Financial reporting is an incredibly sensitive topic for a lot of people, and the financial services access that these people have is really their livelihood. So when we do our work, we really think about them and we really focus on what we're doing for them. Because if we make a mistake with that edge case, somebody is not going to get a loan, they're not going to make rent, or they might lose access to home or vehicle. So our work is very important because we really think about the person at the end of it, and making those mistakes is very costly for them.
As a part of building a factory, my entire existence is because we want to scale. My first year at Proterra, I worked closely with a team of engineers where we built all of our prototype packs exclusively by hand and exclusively by engineers. And that is not something that can scale. I'd say those are probably the most expensive battery packs ever made. But a team of about 15 people, all engineers building by hand for many, many hours. And as we look to scale any sort of automation project, one of the things that we have to do is consider that you have to approach the problem in a completely different way. So you can't use all of the lessons learned in a manual hardware build and apply those in an automated hardware build, because machines work differently than people do. And sometimes that makes it a lot easier, and sometimes that makes it a lot harder. And in order to bridge that gap and tackle those problems quickly, I've found that it is important to do as much process prototyping as possible to prove that that transition from a manual to automated process, you aren't overlooking something big that's going to end up delaying a project. And that's been really key for Proterra as we've scaled our factory.
So for us, this is very particular to our industry, but it's building satellites in a different way. So traditionally, you're building one satellite, you're spending many years on it, and it's kind of a bespoke design. For us, we're doing many satellites. We have 40 that are in orbit right now, and we're getting up to a steady state of 100. So that means we're building, on average, one satellite every single week. And so you definitely have to do things differently. A lot of that is related to doing it almost in an assembly line way. The very first satellite that we built was here in San Francisco, and we did it in, you know, what was basically a conference room with three people, and it took many hours, and we were, you know, frantic to get it out to the airport, you know, within half an hour so that it could make it to the rocket on time. And now it's a completely different story, where we have a whole manufacturing team, the MRP system that we use, the documentation of what is done, so we're not relying on the tribal knowledge of those three people that built the first couple satellites, so that it can actually be done day in, day out, no matter who is building it, that everything is put together the right way. The team that we ended up hiring to do the manufacturing is, again, it's not necessarily the engineers who designed it, which is what it was initially. We've got someone who came in from BlackBerry doing, you know, high volume manufacturing, and the team is not necessarily engineers who actually are putting all the parts together. And those, you know, it's a very different way of doing satellites. That allows us to get to such a large number of them. And then, of course, it's really all about the data and what you do with the data.
So Tostan works in 22 different languages. So you can imagine the scale up from Wolof, which is the language taught in Senegal, or they taught in Senegal. So when they expanded to Guinea-Bissau, you have Portuguese. I won't name them all. So all of the material, because they work in resource-poor communities that are essentially illiterate, you can't hand people textbooks. The program eventually, over the 3 years, does some work in literacy and numeracy, but you have to create new classroom materials in the language, because Tostan teaches in national languages. And funders don't appreciate that expense has to be built into the process. I would also say that we had to totally change our M&E system, because, as you say, the sort of indigenous knowledge of the people who first worked in the program was not easily translatable to the new countries that Tostan went into. And we also need a system that can standardize across countries that have some cultural variation. So we have a grant from the Gates Foundation that's very interesting in terms of helping us do a monitoring and evaluation system that really gives program feedback country to country, allows us to ask really important questions about why Mali, for example, is not, you know, the attitudes there aren't changing as fast as in another country.
Wow, very interesting. So for large projects, you need a lot of people. So what necessary partnerships have you had to make in your work? Examples include partnering with government or outsourcing part of your project to another company, or even relying on local people in the field. So how do you decide when to do something in-house versus relying on a partnership?
Yeah. When we're thinking about, like, if we're going to build it or buy it, we have to really decide long-term, does it make sense for us to really invest all this time into programming it, having people on staff to maintain it long-term, and then dealing with the updates that we're going to need to do inevitably. So when we make that build and buy decision, there are a few things we kind of think about. The first of which is, like, is it our core competency? LendUp is really focused on, and the data science team on at LendUp is really focused on one thing, making machine learning models to do better underwriting, get people more approvals with lower loss rates, and pass that savings on to them. And so we focus on that. As a result, a lot of times other data science teams at big companies might build their own BI solutions or visualizations or, you know, their own internal infrastructure. And you have to decide, you know, we necessarily can't do that. We can pull something off the shelf because there are tons of BI solutions, or we can use Airflow or something else from another company that's open source. So oftentimes we try to just figure out, is this something we are really good at? And if it is, we're going to keep doing it. Other times, though, especially because of the whole regulatory, I have to always talk about compliance, we really try to partner and work with the people that are monitoring us. We invite them in. We are very different than, I think, the Wells Fargo and Citibanks of the world, in that we really want them to come in, investigate us, look at us, help us understand that how we are doing things is how they expect us to stay compliant. We want to stay in that safe harbor area and really respect the rules, because it's very important for us. So in that vein, we really try to partner with the state and federal agencies that do monitor us and help us understand what they're looking for when we do business.
I love your answer, because I cannot echo enough that you have to think about what your core competency is and think about what your business does. So for example, at Proterra, we make electric buses, and that necessitates making batteries. And to make batteries, you have to make a factory, and that may be full of robots. We do not make robots. And if we were to hire a bunch of people and invest in a team, and which we could do, we could make a team of people that's incredible at designing pieces of equipment, but then what would they do after they're done? And so it's better for us on projects like that, that are outside of what our business model is set up to achieve, to hire outside help for those. So a lot of my job is actually co-designing with outside integrators and working with them to help us accomplish our automation needs on the manufacturing floor. And we have a small team working on automation instead of the about 60 engineers that it took for these projects. Only two of them work at Proterra. And I think that that's thinking about your business and the direction that you're going is really important when you're making those decisions.
So I guess I'll say something that maybe is slightly controversial, and I would say that partnerships are tricky. And I think it's something where both sides need to have skin in the game. And, you know, often that means monetary skin in the game in some way. Otherwise, I think there's a long-term chance that the partnership will not be successful and potentially even cause more damage. You know, we build our satellites. We initially started off thinking that we could use a lot of commercial off-the-shelf components, tap into the supply chain. What we want to focus on is the data and what you do with the data, not per se the satellite constellation. And what we ended up finding out is that we had more to lose about the parts, with the parts are not delivered on time, not delivered to spec, do not work once they're in space, than any of our suppliers did. And so we ended up bringing pretty much everything in-house. So we do the whole design of the spacecraft. We do all of the, you know, all of the subsystem components ourselves. We integrate everything ourselves. We test everything ourselves. We do the whole chain minus the rocket launch. So, you know, in that sense, we're not building rockets. But we're doing everything else. And, you know, and that was a lesson for us in, you know, where do partnerships work and where do they not, and how do you have to structure it? And I would say the same thing can also be the case on the distribution side. If you're working with resellers or you're partnering with international organizations or NGOs or any other type of organization, that it needs, you know, they can be powerful for sure. They can also be a time sink if there's not a very clear understanding of, you know, alignment, but also, you know, skin in the game, I would say.
So Toastdown partners with NGOs a lot, but I think its most valued partnership is with the social mobilizers who actually grow out of the educational experience they have and become what we call the sort of agents of organized diffusion. They spread what they've learned, and they're very sort of, when you do development from the inside out, they know how to work with their family members. They know how to work in their with their extended family members. So you have them sort of leading their own development, and that partnership has led to a couple of interesting developments. Toastdown leaves in place what they call a community management committee, and they have, the really dynamic ones have begun federating, so, and they are now independent NGOs that get their own money. The other thing that's happening is that especially women are running for political office on human rights platforms, and so they're able now to affect policy at the local region. And so I would say that the most valuable partnership Toastdown really has is with the people who are emerging out of the classes that are taught.
That's incredible. I really like how I can ask the same question and then get different responses based on the context. So the second last question is, when doing projects at a large scale, important aspects of the work can be lost. For example, product quality and manufacturing, or accommodating all your users in software, or even retaining the personal relationships that drive change in a social initiative. So what aspects of your work are easier at scale, and what aspects are the most challenging to do well at scale?
I think I've kind of harped on the hard parts, right? It's edge cases. It's dealing with the fact that when you've got a million people, $1 billion churning through your platform, something's going to go wrong. It's inevitable. So instead, I just want to harp on the parts that get easier, because I think that's really the benefit of the field. When you do things at scale in my field, you get a lot more data, and a lot more information is powerful, because you need that information to make good inferences and good predictions. From the machine learning side, more data just means you have better predictions. We can get better loss rates, better approval rates. Again, we pass that savings on to the customer. It's fantastic to just have a huge amount of data churning through your platform. As another benefit from the data science side, when you've got a lot of people and a lot of data, suddenly you get to make, you know, try something new, try experimentation. It's hard when you've got a small amount of customers to try anything new. You've got to retain them, and you've got to make sure you're getting it right just for them. But when you've got room to play with, you suddenly find yourself able to test new things. Just one small example from my work is that we're finding that just adjusting the default amount of a loan by $25 can drastically change repayment rates. It turns out that for people that we are lending to, that $25, that default that they normally run with because they're not tending to engage with the full site, makes a huge difference in repayment rates. And it's small things like that can really go a long way.
Can you just repeat the question, please?
Yeah. What aspects of your work are the most challenging to do well at scale? And how do you approach this? And what aspects are easier to do at scale?
Thanks for the reminder. For us, one of the challenges of scaling has been maintaining our quality despite scaling. And I have found that you have to communicate what you need from a quality standpoint in the right way. And it's not just the binary, this is good, this is bad, it's why. And communicating that why can be very challenging in a technical environment when you're speaking to somebody with a completely different background than you. And that's been a challenge that I've been working on with my team a lot. And the great thing about scaling is that things go so fast. Since April, my company has made 30 times the number of batteries that we made in the prior year. And it is so great to have that information available and get more buses out on the road.
I mean, I would echo that. The great thing about scaling is that things go so fast and you're just constantly surprised where you can be. We started the beginning of the summer at 20 satellites, and now we're mid-August and we have 40 satellites. And so we just did 3 launches in the past 2 months. And that's just neat and exciting. The difficult side is to go back to a little bit what I was talking about in one of the earlier questions, which is people. And the thing that we worry about the most and is what we find the most challenging. And so when you're still a smaller company and you're the 10 people, you can manage the culture. You have everyone coming in and they care about it and they feel special because they're part of building something early on. And that's so difficult to do as you grow. I mean, it's something everybody talks about in Silicon Valley of how do you do that as you add more people. And I would say it really is a challenge to make sure that everybody is staying excited and driving towards the bigger picture when you don't necessarily know everyone and you're not touching and talking with them directly. Say sometimes it feels like we spend more time almost dealing with internal things around culture and engagement and keeping everyone moving in the same direction than we spend with external related things. And sometimes that's frustrating, but that's humans, and humans are messy, and at the end of the day, that's just as important as the external facing side.
So I would put it in terms of training. That's the challenge when you're scaling up. Especially if you're going to have fidelity to both the philosophy and the product in your terms, but in terms of the educational program. So training is a great challenge because you have to train facilitators in all of these different countries. But once the program starts, the energy level that's produced is just, as they're saying, really phenomenal. So now with Toast On's program, 7,000 communities have come together in public settings to declare their intention to abandon female genital cutting and child marriage. And they are celebrations. These are events that are planned by the people who come, the politicians come, everyone is involved in this. It's really a new social norm that is beginning. So once it's at scale, it's just amazing.
That's really cool. Okay, so the last question is the one that I'm most curious about. Clearly, you all do a lot of work. Many of you are part of startups or otherwise doing work with a high burnout rate. So what personal sacrifices have you made for your work? And do you have any advice for the audience about burnout and prioritizing what's important to you?
Yeah, I am looking forward to this question as well. This month, I am taking my company's credit card to scale from thousands to hundreds of thousands. I am preparing my first international travel conference and workshops, like never traveled before. Certainly have to navigate that. I'm moving apartments at the same time all this month. If you live in San Francisco, you understand what a total nightmare that is. And I'm also trying to figure out how to be 30 at the same time. So like this month has been very, very busy and I have no time. So the truth is, I'm being held together mostly with coffee and glue. At any given moment, I might fall apart. But the truth is the motivation of like the enormity of what we're about to do with the credit card product really keeps me going. How to deal with it. I'm a very happy guy. I'm very optimistic. I am also very stoic about these kinds of things. My suggestions are prepare to fail. You're going to fail a lot. Everyone's going to tell you you're wrong. You're going to have to get ready for things to go badly. You're going to have to prepare for that and learn how to pick yourself up a lot. Ultimately, it's not about succeeding on every go. It really doesn't work that way. My mentor has pretty much said repeatedly, we gain success through repeated, brutal, and awful failure. That is how machine learning works best. And it turns out to do it well. So it's a good philosophy to adapt when you're doing something new and difficult.
As far as personal burnout goes, I met you in the midst of one of the most challenging times of my career, which was earlier this year, where we had less than a month until our factory launched. And it was a time where every single project I ever worked on was coming together, and it was very challenging and time-consuming. And one of the tools that I found was leaning on the people around me and helping get the people that I was working with as committed to those projects as I was, because then when I was low, there's somebody to lean on and bring me back up. And that is good for the times where I was working very hard and long hours, but I also intend to lead a cyclical life, and I will have 4 months where I work nonstop, and I will plan that I have time to not work as hard, like right now, where I actually will leave work on time for dinner sometimes. And I think planning in advance that I will have a cyclical life and know that I will have no social obligations from January to April, but then month with travel and time with friends after that, it makes those really hard pushes easy to get through because you know what's next.
I think the reality is that burnout is a very real thing. I know there have been some pretty publicized debates recently in Silicon Valley about whether you can have it all and be successful and have balance, or whether you really do need to almost work yourself to death in order to accomplish something big. And at least in my and you know, our experience with our company is that sometimes if you want to do something that is very challenging and that you think will have a big impact and hasn't been done before, the reality is that you just have to run and work harder and faster than anyone else. And I think that's a very real thing. For us, and we have gone all in on this. My husband actually also works with our company. He's the CEO and a co-founder. So we've been building this organization together. I was pregnant with our daughter when we were fundraising together for Series A. And, you know, when she was a month old, he came home and said, well, I think we have to move to Scotland, where we're opening the manufacturing plant for the satellites. And so we moved to Scotland as soon as she got her vaccinations. And then from there, it's just been everywhere I go, she travels with me. And I have babysitters, and we're registered in daycares around the world. And so it's just we're all in. It's a constant whirlwind of managing everything. And I think for us, it has worked that we're doing it together as a family. And I think it would be very, very difficult if you have someone with that level of focus and the spouse or partner is not involved in it and really has a hard time understanding why things need to be a certain way. And so it's made it all in. I mean, we took that risk. We have no side job or stable income outside of the company that we've created. And we're bouncing around between continents, and our whole life is in this thing. But at the same time, I think that's what's made it possible as well.
It's interesting that you've asked this question. I'm not the entrepreneur. Actually, Molly Melching is my sister, so I've seen firsthand burnout. However, she's not burned out when she's close to the people, to the source. She gets burned out by bureaucracy, management kinds of issues. But Ashoka and the Skoll Foundation have recognized that social entrepreneurs have a high burnout rate. And they have designed retreats. She's going through one of them right now, where people have a chance to sit back and do reflection, and they can't talk about work. And this has been transformative. I really recommend that people think about scheduling a time for reflection with others who are doing similar kind of work. I mean, certainly you can reflect alone. A lot of people do meditation. But it's actually being with like-minded people who are experiencing similar kinds of pressures and frustrations to develop yourself outside of the boundaries of your work life.
Amazing. So that was the last question I have. We will be here for office hours until about 5:10 if you want to talk to any of the panelists. And do we have time for audience questions?
So I think rather than taking audience questions for everyone, we should just thank our panel now, and then you can come up and ask questions. And the next talks will be in here at 5:15, which will be a round of lightning talks. So let's thank our panel.